So working with the documentation of UNRWA, IRO, the Vatican Relief Body, the British military administrations that administer various parts of former Italian Africa, as well as the Dodecanese Islands, you have many instances where this question comes up again and again. Sometimes it's direct requests by the individuals themselves saying, please, we would like to be considered refugees, we would like international assistance, for example, to immigrate overseas. Sometimes there are very powerful representatives from the Italian state, from the Vatican, advocating that these individuals should be considered refugees and accorded the rights and the benefits that other displaced persons were receiving in Europe at the time. Now, it's probably not so remarkable that you would see this story of a kind of narrowing of the refugee category in this time period. When you think about the move from UNRWA to IRO, International Refugee Organization, there's a huge expansion of benefits that come with that move. And IRO has in its remit to care, maintain, and resettle these refugees. So these are very costly entitlements, and thus the question of eligibility becomes particularly acute, right? So we can see on the ground why personnel in these agencies had to really think about who can we include as a bona fide refugee. But it's all. What's more surprising to me is why the critical scholarship also tends to just dismiss these individuals and groups out of hand. So in the paper, I try to think about why is it that much of the scholarship replicates the kind of practical and legal exclusion of these individuals from the refugee category. And one of the things that I argue and look at, and please tell me if I'm getting close to my time,
nope.
Is the ways in which, first of all, I mean, this going to something Keith said in his keynote, I mean, this is a story where decolonization in the Italian context intersects directly with the European displaced persons crisis after World War II. And yet the scholarship keeps these stories separate, treats them as distinct. In the Italian case, one can say, well, okay, the Italian case is unusual. And yet we have similar things going on in the Dutch possessions. And then we have a whole range of other population flows in the early post-war period that in many cases are directly related to decolonization, so the partition of India. We have the emergence of the Palestinian refugee question. And yet, because all of these groups are excluded from the 1951 Geneva Convention on Refugees, which sets temporal and geographic limits, there's this way in which certainly scholars have taken up those different population flows, but there's this kind of chronology in the literature that the global refugee crisis emerges after the resolution of the European refugee crisis. And it's absolutely not true, right? They're happening simultaneously. But one of the consequences of the exclusion of all these other types of displaced persons from the legal definition of refugee and the international assistance regime is that, as I see it, you essentially have a series of regional regimes for refugee relief that come into being at the same time, or roughly the same time, but only one acquires sort of normative status, and that is the one that is built around the European refugee crisis. So I talk in the paper, I talk a lot more about these kind of dilemmas in the scholarship and the dangers of replicating legal exclusions or taking legal exclusions as empirical ones, which of course not all scholars do, but is a feature of a lot of the research. And then I also think about why the literature on colonialism has also tended to neglect the question of these repatriates. And again, I mean, I'm not going to have time to go into it here, but one of the real issues there is the question of whether these colonial repatriates are examples of forced migration. And some recent scholars, Andrea Smith, who's an anthropologist who works on the Pied Noir, has really tried to look at this question, and she's come up with a kind of typology of free, coerced, forced migration that tries to lend greater complexity to the debate, but it's still always hung up on this kind of dichotomy of is it voluntary or is it coerced, which is a problem that runs throughout the migration literature, of course, and doesn't really recognize the very complicated calculus of constraint and coercion that individuals migrating face, both in this particular case, but of course more generally. And I find that that's just one of these become a very unproductive question for various kinds of migration studies, whether it's refugee studies or migration more generally. Just to say a little bit more about the specific case, whereas there's a way in which in the scholarship, the history of these repatriates, and in this case Italian repatriates, is largely invisible. And Andrea Smith has called these return migrants, or she calls them reverse migrants. She's called them Europe's invisible migrants. But at the time, these were highly visible migrants in many instances. So, I mean, I want to ask, how are they rendered invisible in the scholarship over time? And for the Italian government, for example, there was no question. The Italian government was very aware of the kinds of constraints that individuals in the former possessions faced. Sometimes direct forms of intimidation, economic difficulties, and so on. And yet it's also a very complicated picture because in many instances the Italian government slowed down the rhythms or sought to slow down the rhythms of migration. The repatriation processes were often very cumbersome and quite complicated. And